Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books and Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton of Deerfield Academy, and I'm happy to be joined today by Christina Gerhart. She's associate professor at University of Hawaii at Manoa and a senior fellow at the University of California, Berkeley. Her environmental journalism has appeared in Grist, The Nation, The Progressive, and The Washington Monthly, and she's here now to talk about her second book. It's called Sea Change: An Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean. It comes out today from University of California Press. Dr. Gerhart, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be with you.
This is such a cool project, and it's really one that has to be seen and kind of held in one's hand to be believed. It's sort of this just this wonderful environmental studies coffee table book of all sorts, and it does much more than that. Also, it's but we'll do our best to give listeners a sense of it. But before we get into the unusual architecture and the formatting of the book, I'd love to just talk about your approach to the topic of islands and their inhabitants. In your introduction, you position your book as offering a narrative vantage point, in your words, distinct from those from which islands have so often been viewed by outsiders. So what are these kind of distorting traditions that you're pushing against here in this project?
Right. Yeah. Thanks for the question. Thanks to an opening and just mentioning what a gorgeous, in your words, book the Sea Change is. It really it is one that's best held in the hands, as you put it, rather than read as a PDF. I thank Leah Chandra, University of California Press's in-house designer, and Molly Roy, who made the maps in the book, for all of their contributions. It's very much intended to be an atlas in the old-fashioned sense, but a decolonized one. Which brings me to your question. I noticed when I moved to Hawaii about 12 years ago to take up this position at the University of Hawaii, and I was reading a lot of different literature, both about islands, but also by islanders. And one of the things that I noticed, one of the things that Sea Change pushes against two traditions, and the first one is really a Western colonial tradition of reading islands. So your listeners may have read growing up, you know, Western literature dating back to, I don't know, Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe or Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea from the 18th and 19th century, respectively, or even more recent 20th century books such as Golding's Lord of the Flies. So I was looking at these texts and I thought this is really interesting. They're giving us a framing of islands that often features cannibalism or boys shipwrecked on an island and things don't end so well in the case of Lord of the Flies, all sorts of things that had so little to do with what I was seeing and experiencing living every day on islands. And then most importantly, the kinds of things that I was learning about by reading the actual texts of islanders. So that's, you know, that's the first thing that I'm really trying to do is push back against these traditions and center instead islanders' voices. The other thing that you already touched on a little bit in your description of the book is that Sea Change really engages and builds on scientific reports about sea level rise, but it expands the focus. In my estimation, we have enough scientific reports about the climate crisis and sea level rise, by which I don't mean the scientific research is unimportant or that we don't need new reports. What I mean is Sea Change builds on that science and it brings in other disciplines. I often refer to it as a symphony, by which I mean that it yes, feature science, but also the maps that I mentioned previously. There's art, there's essays, and there's poetry. And then again, it centers the voices of Islanders, specifically Indigenous Pacific and Black Caribbean Islanders. So they share the stories of their histories, their cultures, and knowledges. And I think that's really important in a book about sea level rise, because as you said, it's a coffee table book. It's a bleak topic, but it makes people want to engage with the topic. But it tells you what is at stake. It opens up, you know, the connection of caring as one learns about these histories and these cultures and these languages and ways of life that are at risk.
That's great. I want to get back to a lot of that. I was thinking how the book really makes clear, you know, breaks through the colonial gaze and all of that, and it really makes clear the diversity of experiences on islands around the world. But at the same time, when you read it kind of end to end, you see these common experiences that people who live on islands, no matter how far apart from each other they live their lives, they share. And the islands and islanders share quite a lot. And so what would you say are some of the common features of island experience?
Yeah, some of the common features. So what I noticed immediately in Hawaii that I found of interest and took note of is that there's affinities between or among Hawaiian Islanders and people on or from, because a lot of this book is also about diasporic populations and the reasons why people live in diasporas. But there's affinities between Hawaiian Islanders and people on or from the Philippines, from Guam, from Cuba, and from Puerto Rico. And the reason, even though those geographies are really distant, some of those geographies I just mentioned, some of those islands are in the Pacific, some are in the Caribbean, and then they're in different parts of the Pacific. The reason is, despite the distances, they'd all been involved in the U.S. Spanish War. So on the negative side of the ledger, the answer to your question about these affinities that islanders have with one another is a direct result of colonialism that can manifest in linguistic affinities that often also erase indigenous languages and islands in the Pacific. So the Spanish language among all the islands I just mentioned would be an example. But it's colonialism and modern day imperialism. On the positive side of the ledger, because a lot of this book is about putting indigenous or Caribbean, Black Caribbean often, but not exclusively, of putting those histories out there, on the positive side of the ledger, there's deep histories of affinities that exist among islanders. So in the Pacific, there's Tongan theorist and writer Epiliha Ofa. He writes about how colonizers read islands as remote and distant, but of how islanders themselves, seeing themselves in a deep ocean that is their center, read themselves as connected. And interestingly, when I was reading some of the writings of Edward Glisson about the Caribbean, he was writing about this concept of what he calls relationality, and how islanders in the Caribbean, respecting all the differences among these islands, they still view themselves as very connected because of their geography. And I thought, isn't that interesting? It's such a different way of seeing islands once you actually view them from within that ocean or that sea, right? There's these affinities.
I love that. And although one could imagine taking on an intellectual project like this and turning out a traditional monograph or any other kind of forms. And so what made you choose the Atlas?
The reason that I decided to work with the form of the Atlas, which is really one of the most colonial forms of literature right. And of mapping, right? It really follows with this explore, you know, this vantage point of exploring, of navigation, of, you know, the supposed new and the supposed, you know, terra nullius, the empty land that is supposedly discovered. One of the reasons I decided to work with the Atlas is actually to decolonize the Atlas. So I have a couple of examples of, I looked for and also included, looked for in the archives or in conversations with people in different communities, examples of indigenous mapping. And I have two examples in the book. One is in Greenland, where these wooden maps are created. And Greenland is what opens the Atlas, because the source of there's a lot of land ice there. About 85% of the Greenland is ice. Often it's ice sheets that are 2 feet deep. And when it melts, it is the source of sea level rise as far away as the Marshall Islands. So I open with Greenland. But in Greenland, there are these wooden maps, and explorers were kind of surprised when they were learning about them from the indigenous Inupiaq that live in Greenland, that they weren't used in the way that people in the West use maps, which is that they try to, you know, relate what they're seeing to what is on the page in front of them. It was holding these wooden maps and telling the story of the land formation. It was that story and the embodied experience that was most important, to the extent that the wooden maps themselves were carved and then were disposed of. They weren't used for the journey. They were learning tools. They were like these assistances in coming to understand the land that one was moving through. And that's a radical shift from the way that maps get used in the West. I have stick charts from the Marshall Islands that are included, and they have this kind of contrast to Western notions of mapping too. They include swells, which are related to but different from waves. They're deeper, they move at longer lengths than waves do. And importantly, swells are these longer, deeper, waves that get bent by islands. So if you can read the swells and you notice that there's a bent swell, you know that there's an island up ahead. Now that's an attuneness to the water around you that is incredibly deep. But when you see the stick charts, it means that they have, they have a very different kind of relationship to the world around them than Western kinds of maps do. And one of the reasons that I include these kinds of examples is both to include indigenous ways of mapping, but also because Western colonizers were utterly befuddled when they landed in the Pacific and they were encountering these incredible navigators who didn't have things like, the magnetic compass, who weren't using latitude and longitude, right? Longitude is mapped onto the Greenwich coordinates. And so they weren't using these kinds of systems of navigation. This is true in Arab navigation, also Chinese navigation, that predates certain systems and conventions that are common to North and West Europe. And so what I was trying to do was also tell different stories and histories of navigation. Yeah, and so to decolonize the atlas.
there's lots of great history of science and history of technology in the book too. You've got so much in there. It's amazing. I'm wondering, I think Google told me there's 900,000 islands on the planet. I don't know how we get an actual count, if it's even possible. Your book is substantial, but you profile about 50. And the diversity is really exciting, right? There are these South Sea Islands that you can imagine, Robinson Crusoe living on. There's also Singapore as a nation state. There's our city state. There's also, is it Deal Island in the Chesapeake Bay? And so it's really an exciting diversity of places. How did you choose?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I mean, obviously, given the numbers that you just mentioned in terms of how many islands there are, I could not include all. And you also included a beautiful range because there's 49 in Sea Change, 49 islands. They are not all island nations. So I intentionally included islands that are of a diverse range of entities. The Deal Island is obviously, is not an island nation. It's in Chesapeake Bay. It's part of the U.S. So there's examples along those lines. There are islands that are colonized, and they get into that tricky history. I chose the 49 islands I did, starting with the most at-risk islands. So the islands that are most at risk of sea level rise globally, and the book is global in scope, as you were mentioning. The four that are most at risk are Kiribati, the Marshall Islands, and Tuvalu in the Pacific, and then the Maldives in the Indian Ocean. And there's two different types of islands. Those are all atolls or low-lying islands. And those are islands that are, as the name indicates, low-lying and most at risk of being underwater. By contrast, there's high islands or volcanic islands. And I included some volcanic islands, which I went back and forth with both my cartographer and the editor at UC Press about this, because they both had questions about why to include high islands. And the reason is fairly simple once one thinks about it. High islands or volcanic islands typically have a dome. They're often, the name volcanic indicates this, they're often still active volcanoes. And because they have that peak, most of the people that live on volcanic islands are clustered around the coastline because the inland area is so steep and it's also at risk of having that volcano potentially become active again. And that clustering around the coastline puts them right in the way of sea level rise. So even if the whole island might not be as at risk as a low-lying atoll island of being totally underwater, the people who are in the infrastructure, right, that that typically follows people or that people set up for themselves close to where they live are both really at risk, even on high islands. But I decided to go with 49. We were talking about different numbers. We wavered between 20 and 50. I wanted enough variation. The book is very webby in its structure, so it doesn't need to be read from beginning to end. It's very browsable by design, because it's a coffee table book, because it's intended to engage the modern attention span. So it can be read and browsed, you know, can be read in bits and chunks and browsed in a non-sequential order. That is to some extent also echoing the geographic space of islands within an ocean, that one can, you know, jump from this location to that location. But there's enough islands that there's reinforcement of certain ideas. So infrastructure, which I've mentioned, which includes roads or airports, are often located close to waterways, especially on continents, you know, in Boston or New York City or the San Francisco Bay Area. Power plants, water waste treatment facilities, all often close to water. So I trace infrastructure. I also trace, say, sea turtle nesting grounds on a couple of these islands with enough repetition that people get the point, and without the terrible phrase beating a dead horse. just rehashing the idea ad nauseum. So that's part of what's going on with the structure of the book. 49 is an homage to the San Francisco Bay Area, which is home. So it's that 7x7 mile space, or the 49-mile scenic drive here, the 49ers. So there's however you want to read it, it's reference to home.
I love that Easter egg. You know, you mentioned your cartographer, and for most of the islands here, your entry features an original map that depicts the current day coastline and then predicted coastlines for 2050 and 2100, or whatever we end up calling that year when we get there. You know, there is a scientific consensus about rising oceans. We all know that, but the act of depicting future coastlines isn't an objective exercise, right? It's there's a lot of choices to make there. And so what makes it tricky to draw those lines as you both drew, and how do you make the choices that are required to do that?
Right. Thank you for catching that. So I drew on the UN scientific body is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC for short. And they put out these reports roughly every 5 years. They just put out their sixth assessment report last year. And that's what I drew on for the science. There's consensus, you know, among scientists, and they're usually at the conservative end of these kinds of projections, by which I mean whatever the IPCC says, any article that one reads that's an update of that in the Washington Post or in the New York Times, you know, or the LA Times reporting on the latest science, you know, published in Nature, or whatever, is going to be more intense than this. So the IPCC says we're going to get a foot by 2050, we're going to get 3 feet by 2100. So those are the numbers that we basically used, totally aware of the fact that by the time the book was out, you know, 10 other studies were going to have superseded this, and it was going to keep going that way. We're talking about whether or not we want to do a web version of the book to keep it more up to date, or just kind of, you know, a companion on the web. And then there's questions of who keeps it up, you know, yada, yada about that. But so the science that Molly Roy, who's the cartographer for Sea Change, used is science that I gave her. And one of the things that I had to discuss with her, but also with my editor, other people at the UC end, is that sea level rise isn't a line. It's really best thought of as a zone of inundation. So looking for that line on the map and drawing that line on the map is one way of depicting sea level rise. But what makes a place uninhabitable is being flooded again and again and again. So the Marshall Islands that I mentioned previously, one of the foremost at-risk island nations, they rest on average 6.5 feet above sea level rise. So when I say we're going to get 3 feet by the end of the century, people might breathe a sigh of relief and say, oh, okay, well, they're not at risk. They're not going to be underwater. In fact, they've already declared states of emergency twice because of extreme flooding, and once because of drought. So it's really this you know, this being inundated and not being able to live a livable life on atolls anymore, that's the issue. That's one thing that makes it really tricky to draw lines like we do. And I think just getting into this issue in the text and the prose about zones of inundation versus lines was one of the things that we thought about with regard to the relationship between the maps and the text. And those are conversations we had too, is how do you relate what's being demonstrated or visualized in the maps and what's going on in the text. So another kind of example of risks of inundation is salinization, which basically refers to salt content in, say, soil or in freshwater aquifers. A lot of island nations really they're subsistence farmers, so they rely on what they can grow or they rely on what they can fish to feed themselves. They don't walk down to the local grocery store, in other words. And when you have saltwater coming in through the ocean, through this kind of lapping at the shores and inundating the soil structure, it means that the crops take up fresh water, they can't take up salty water. And it means that agriculture is increasingly at risk. A lot of island nations also rely on, like the Marshall Islands that I mentioned, they're a few yards across and they're a couple miles long, the atolls that constitute the Marshall Islands, so really tiny spaces of land, and they don't have rivers running through them. So they rely for all of their freshwater, they rely on the rainwater that falls from the sky. So they have rainwater catchment systems, or they have freshwater aquifers. And again, when you get the sea level rise increase, it can salinize the freshwater. So then they don't have enough freshwater. So there's a number of risks associated with this inundation that makes life increasingly difficult on these atolls.
That is really a major theme of the book. We see chapter after chapter is the way that it's beyond just eroding coastlines. We have lots of ways that rising water threatens island communities. And even we see in several places, it threatens communities far away from islands that are linked to islands through things like undersea communication cables, or even less kind of benignly overseas military bases. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, the way that continental folks are threatened by rising levels in oceans.
Yeah, I mean, this comes back to I think the islands are really important in terms of military, but also in terms of undersea nodes. Nicole Starzelski has published a book a couple years ago called Undersea Networks. And it really traces the infrastructure, meaning in this case, specifically what was in the early 20th century cable lines, and then later and in our present day became internet connections. So people often think of the internet, she points out, as being something that is all air focused, in the cloud, in the sky, like these kinds of things, right? And that is true to a certain extent, but a lot of the cables really still connect through these incredibly dense cable clusters that run through the ocean. Tonga, the Pacific Island nation of Tonga, which is one of it is actually, I think, the only nation in the Pacific that was never colonized and has continuously had an indigenous monarchy. Tonga is a major node for deep sea cables, but that also means whenever we have hurricanes, you know, they might be at risk. Tonga's had outages a couple of times. The geographer and artist Trevor Paglen, who granted me permission to reprint a couple of his pieces of art in the book, he traveled extensively looking to photograph these kind of connections on the west coast and the east coast of the U.S. He has a couple photographs from Morro Bay in California, and then a couple from different parts in on the east coast around New York City. And then he was also in the Pacific. He was in Hawaii, and he photographed in a couple of different places. The really unsuspecting places where these deep sea networks form a cluster. So that's really important, but they layer, as Nicole Starzelski argues in her book, they really layer onto earlier colonial histories of connections. So the early colonizers and the islands that, you know, say the U.S. or say Spain or name another entity, Japan, the nations that they had colonized were nations among which they typically laid different kind of cable networks. And that's something she talks about in her book.
And then speaking of military bases, in your chapter on Guam, you note that the island appears on the UN's list of non-self-governing territories, or as you put it, places that have yet to be decolonized. And you note there's 17 territories on that list, which is a number that surprised me. And I can't decide whether I was surprised that there are only 17 or that the number being that small, why are there not zero at this point? And so why do you think colonialism has remained, and almost all of those places are islands. And so why do you think colonialism has remained as strong as it has on islands?
Yeah, thanks for the question and for catching that detail. I do mention that Guam is on the UN's list of non-governing, the UN's list of non-self-governing territories that have yet to be colonized. And most of the territories that are on the list, as you rightly point out, are islands. And I think the reason relates to the previous question where you asked in part about the use of islands for military installations. So I have a big chunky paragraph in the introduction that I was thinking about taking out, and then I decided to leave it in. And the reason I was thinking of taking it out is because it's a list. And of course, as any writer knows, a list does not, you know, does not exemplify that one writes well.
Unless you're Whitman, yeah.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And so I decided to leave it in, and it's a list of the 52, I believe it's 52 off the top of my head. It's the list of the military installations that the U.S. has on islands around the world. And the reason I left it in is because I'm not quite sure that a lot of people know, maybe people who are island dwellers know this, or who have military relations or island relations know this, but I'm not sure that you know, everyone is aware of how many military installations are located on islands. And even once military installations are removed, and this is around the world, even once military installations are removed, they often have really incredibly terrible impacts that remain on islands. So, you know, the Marshall Islands, just to name one example, was subjected to dozens of nuclear tests on Bikini Atoll, which is one of the atolls that makes up the island nation of the Republic of Marshall Islands. Bikini Atoll is no longer inhabitable, and it is the word from which we get, you know, the bikini, the swimsuit kind of gear. But that's one of the examples. Viejes in Puerto Rico was used for bombing practice and still has ordinances in it. There's an island, neighboring Deal Island in Chesapeake Bay, that people are also not allowed to go on to because it was used for bombing practice. There's Ko'olawe, which is an island neighboring. It's one of the Hawaiian islands that neighbors Oahu. So there are all these examples of what islands have been subjected to. And you know, it's not only humans that can't use them, but, you know, it's also all of the flora and fauna, you know, of these islands. Kathy Jetnell Kishner, who's climate envoy for the Marshall Islands and also a poet, she has a poem called History Lesson that your listeners can easily find by just doing a search for History Lesson in Marshall Islands or History Lesson in Kathy. It's a poem about the impacts of the nuclear testing on the Marshall Islands, on Marshall Islanders, and she's lost family members to the impacts, you know, high rates of cancer among them. So this is, you know, these kinds of impacts last. And I think, you know, there's all sorts of things one could say about nuclear energy, which is having a renaissance, but I think that's probably going to take us to a field, but, you know, yeah, I'll just put that there.
She's so great. And she actually, she's an embodiment of something you've mentioned a couple of times that I have not yet having a chance to pick up on, which is that the book is really distinctive for how it incorporates the voice of islanders. This is, I mean, obviously your work is the dominant voice here, but it's a polyvocal work here. And why was that important to you? And could you share a bit about maybe a couple of the specific voices you were excited to include?
Oh, absolutely. I would be delighted to. In fact, I would be delighted to have that be the majority of the show. But I mean, it is really the genesis of the book, right, is what I was talking about in terms of the kind of narratives or the images, you know, from literary history up to military use, up to the tourism industry of islands versus the kinds of stories that islanders share about themselves, which are both bleak, but also, you know, just filled with joy and celebration. So I spent a lot of time in the Pacific Literature Archives at the University of Hawaii at Manoa reading poems. So there's 49 islands, as you mentioned, and each one more or less, but not all of them, have a little poem or a text after a text that I've written by Islanders included, after the text that I wrote after the maps that Molly Roy created. And I spent a lot of time reading the poems and selecting them. So there's, I mean, everything that's mentioned, from the kinds of foods that are on islands, you know, the breadfruit and the guava and the passion fruit, and just which reinforces that notion of really living close to or with the land, and subsistence farming that I was mentioning earlier, the kind of fish that are common in the area. So they really slow us down, I hope, when we read them, and have us think about that space and just linger in it a little bit more. Kathy Jutnell Kuechner's work was really influential for this writing. Craig Santos Perez, who's a colleague at the University of Hawaii and also a poet, Chamorro from Guam, Indigenous Chamorro from Guam, was really influential. Julian Agon is an environmental lawyer, also Chamorro from Guam, who's been working on a case that's made headlines in the last month. He has a law firm called Blue Ocean Law that he co-founded. He's a lawyer, but also a writer. And he put forward this case, he's involved with this case that the Pacific Island Nation of Vanuatu has brought to the International Court of Justice, which is asking that they state that nations in the global north are disproportionately responsible for producing CO2 emissions, and therefore for the kinds of impacts that frontline nations are disproportionately experiencing. We're waiting to see what comes out of that. But he, you know, as I mentioned, he's also a writer, and he has this beautiful book that was published. The original title of it was The Properties of Perpetual Light. And it's recently been republished in the Caribbean. Dion Brand's work was really powerfully influential. She's from Trinidad and Tobago and living diasporically in Toronto. Of course, when I think of Toronto, I think of Christina Sharp's work, the work by Sadia Hartman, and then, of course, Nurbezi Phillips' work, Zong in particular. So there's, yeah. And then Glisson, Braithwaite, their writings. There's, yeah, there's great a whole stuff. World out there.
And a lot of it's in the book, but of course, even more than that. One thing that's in the book that we haven't talked much about, we've talked about what the climate crisis is doing to islands, but we also have a lot to say about what islanders, how they're responding to the climate crisis. And, you know, not all of your maps projecting these future shapes of these islands paint a picture of shrinking islands. We have some islands are getting bigger in the silhouettes in the map here. And so what are quote unquote reclaimed islands, and how do they fit into your exploration of our warming world?
I'm so glad that you caught that, because it isn't only a book about shrinking islands. It is also about growing islands, or what gets called land reclamation. I have issues with that term, and I'm glad you're putting it in, you know, in little quotes as you're using that term, reclaimed. So I have issues with the term land reclamation, because it leads you to believe that it works in terms of the engineering of it. It works by infill, and it leads you to believe the term land reclamation, that the land is being reclaimed. But it's actually not land that is being reclaimed. It is land that is being created by infill. So again, if your listeners are in a more continental environment, you can think about a lot of the geography of Boston and a lot of the geography of the San Francisco Bay. This holds true for New York area too. A lot of the expansion of cities that are located next to water was achieved by dint of infill. And not coincidentally, those are specifically the regions that are most at risk of sea level rise right now. So one of the tricks that I do in my book is to look at old maps of different geographic locations. I've done this in the Boston Public Library. I've done this in New York at the Public Library, and also in San Francisco. And I love public libraries is one thing. I've done this with students. They have so many different treasures. I love libraries that have map collections, also photography collections. And you can use photography for part of this too, to you know, give a different kind of sense of what cities have looked like in different eras. But if you take an old map, like USGS has, the United States Geological Survey has a lot of maps that are available easily online, and I used those for specifically for the work I was doing with Deal Island and the Chesapeake Bay. And I was looking at expansion and contraction of islands. If you look at maps from, say, 1850, and you look at, I use Climate Central, which is a website. They have a website where you can just click in a location and you can look at like what sea level rises for your home address and measure it by 3 feet, by 5 feet, whatever. But they also have maps that are more aerial for different geographies that I used for this book. Climate Central's in Princeton. I had a position at Princeton teaching environment and humanities for a year and a half. Anyways, so I compared these old USGS maps or maps from libraries with Climate Central's sea level rise predictors. NOAA has a sea level rise predictor maps too that people can use, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association or Administration. If you compare the old maps and the current maps, what you will see is the places, like I said, that are most at risk of sea level rise right now are often places that used infill in order to expand their geographic footprint. And I think that's something that's really important to be aware of, whether it's because we're buying real estate, because that's where the school is located and it might be underwater, you know, whatever it is, you know, airports are really at risk for this reason. I think that's a really important phenomenon to be aware of. And then we come back to your question. So there are islands that are reclaiming land. That's a terrible idea for all the reasons that I just mentioned. Right. And yeah, it's understandable. Islands have a limited amount of space. That's why real estate is so expensive in Oahu. The fact that the military is using about a third of the real estate is another thing that drives up the cost and gives us less land for, you know, for agriculture to be self-sustaining. But I think it really creates a precarious situation. So Singapore is doing this, and it's in the Atlas, like you mentioned. Bahrain, the Kingdom of Bahrain, is also in the Atlas and Sea Change, and it's also doing this kind of land reclamation. And those are examples of hard engineering to think one's way out of this pickle of sea level rise. Another example of hard engineering that I engage in the book is raising islands. So there are engineering firms, for the Marshall Islands, for example, they're in conversation in Kiribati with a Japanese engineering firm that has put forward proposals to raise their island. The Maldives is in the process of building an entirely new island now. And that's also in the Atlas. But unlike the Maldives, nations like Kiribati or the Marshall Islands, they have really small GDPs. So they have very limited budgets in order to undertake some of this. And that's, you know, it's a huge issue with sea level rise. And, you know, it is, I mean, the climate crisis, it is one example of the climate crisis, but the disproportionate CO2 emissions, historically, the U.S. is the nation that is most responsible for producing CO2 emissions, or put differently, for creating the climate crisis. Currently, China is producing the most CO2 emissions in the world, but a lot of the discussion there is also around the fact that what is produced in China and goes on their ledger is consumed by Americans and travels over here. And so, like, you know, how should these ledgers in terms of CO2 accounting work? But those are the two nations that are most responsible historically or present day. And island nations that are at the forefront disproportionately of experiencing the impacts of sea level rise are in the Pacific or in the Caribbean, and they've done the least. I mean, island nations have contributed something like, you know, 1% of CO2 emissions, and they're at risk of going under. And that's hugely what motivated this book project.
Speaking, and that's something you come back to a lot, and speaking of that disproportionate emissions and disproportionate threats and the tiny GDPs of island nations, I was reminded of one of the headlines that came out of COP27 back in November, was the establishment of a quote-unquote loss and damage fund. And could you say a bit about what that is for listeners that haven't been briefed on that? And how effectively do you think it addresses this injustice?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that to your listeners' attention. I really appreciate it. So loss and damage was one of the successes out of last year's COP27. So COP27 is the COP, COPs in all caps, are conferences. They're called Conference of the Party, COP, and the parties refer to all the different nations that participate in the conference. So there's 198 198 nations that gather annually, typically towards the end of the year, and they meet as part of the UN to talk about some sort of an international treaty engaging with the climate crisis or addressing the climate crisis. Loss and damage was a success coming out of last year's COP27. A lot of people like to critique the UN in these conferences, and I'll just list up some of the critiques. They're too slow moving is what a lot of people say. They've been taking place for decades and they haven't really led to any kind of a result. Even if there was a treaty that was agreed upon or agreed to, it's not legally binding is another criticism. And I think all of these criticisms are fair. One of the things that I think is really impressive about the UN is it is the one forum, unlike say a G7 or G20 meeting, where all 198 nation states get together, and nations in the global north that are disproportionately responsible for creating the climate crisis have to look the nations that are at the front lines and suffering these impacts in the eye. And, you know, they all get to voice their opinions. And that's the genesis of the book. A lot of people think it's because I've been living in Hawaii. It actually predates that. So I've been covering these climate negotiations since 2009. And what I noticed as a journalist in covering them is, so what you hear is you hear the 198 nations individually stand up, and before they weigh in on a point, they'll say, well, the situation in my home country, I just want to acknowledge is as follows. So last year was Pakistan, a third of, you know, the country was, it was flooded, a third of the country was underwater, there was billions of dollars of damage, 3,000 people died, and half of the deaths were children. The other issue last year that kept coming up was the drought in the Horn of Africa. So nations stand up individually. They also stand up as part of clusters. In UN speak, that's the least developed countries of the Africa group or the Alliance of Small Island States. And so they'll say these kinds of things, and then they'll weigh in on whatever point is being discussed. And what I found interesting there is, although I, as a journalist, having a seat, you know, at the table there, at least covering it and hearing this day in and day out, had a good sense after 2 weeks of what was going on worldwide. When I looked at even really great institutions that, you know, publications that have great climate coverage, The Guardian, for example, consistently does and has for decades had great coverage of the climate crisis, you'd find the U.S.-China standoff dominating the headlines. And I want to be totally clear, I don't think that issue is unimportant. I think it's a crucial piece of the puzzle. But I was like, where are these islanders' voices and what they are disproportionately experiencing? So to come back to loss and damage, this is a huge success coming out of last year. Nations from the global south have been pushing really hard for this for 30 years. This is a fund that they have been working to get established for decades. And Tina Stege, who is a climate envoy from the Marshall Islands, was at the forefront of leading this. It's, of course, as many political movements are, a collective effort. But it was a huge success last year. What it means for people who aren't familiar with the lingo is that a facility, some sort of a funding mechanism be set up so that nations in the global north pay nations in the global south who are disproportionately experiencing the impacts of loss and of damage. Loss is irretrievable, and damage refers to the things that have been damaged but were recovery as possible. But this is a real demand for, some have referred to it as reparations, others have pushed back against that language. But it is, in essence, it is, you know, putting forward an acknowledgement of this disproportionate responsibility. And then there's the issue that I mentioned of the GDPs, right? The disproportionately small GDPs in the global south and frontline communities being able to deal with this. Barbados's Prime Minister Mia Motley has been terrific at thinking about these financial structures, and she's been asking for, and I wrote both about loss and damage. I also wrote about Mia Motley's plans. It's been called the Barbados proposal, but she's been asking for a rethinking of everything basically that came out of the 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement. So the World Bank, the IMF, the way that these entities give out loans, she's asking for them to rethink their funding mechanisms, taking into account both that some of the debt is a direct result of colonialism, but also taking account climate crisis, and that a lot of nations now have debt because they're disproportionately spending their budgets on dealing with the climate crisis. And I'm really curious to see what comes out of that.
Well, I'm imagining and hoping and expecting that the months ahead will have you very busy talking about islands with readers, especially hopefully ignorant continent dwellers like myself. But looking a little further ahead here, when you find yourself with some more time, do you have any future projects in mind that you'd be willing to give listeners a sneak preview of?
Thanks for the question. I do want to cycle. I want to track the work of Mia Motley in revising the financial systems. I think there's a lot of structures that come out of the World War II era. We have the Convention on Refugees that does not include the word climate refugee.
Right.
That's one big overhaul that people have been pushing forward. Some are critical. Some think that would be helpful. I'm interested in following that debate. And then, you know, her call for rethinking a lot of those structures that also grew out of the end of the Nazi era and World War II. So I'm really tracking some of those changes because, you know, goodness, 70 years later, we definitely need to rethink some of those structures. I'm thinking of working on a future book that engages sea level rise in cities globally. So that's the preview for the next book project.
Cool, cool. Well, for the time being, we're very lucky to have this book, which is again, Sea Change, An Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean. It comes out today from University of California Press. Its author is, and my guest has been, Christina Gerhardt. Tina, thank you so much for your time and for this gorgeous and important book.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been great to be with you, Brian.